This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
As always, we go digging deeper with one very special guest for a whole hour, and they get to choose their own music. And unfortunately, his first choice of music was Rick Astley, the Lights Out. Why did you pick that, Rod Swift?
Well, everyone knows I'm a bit of a joker, so I thought if we could pick any track for the first one, I'd want a Rick Roll people, but in a way that's nice and new music rather than the usual Rickroll fare. So, look, I've been a bit of a Rick Astley fan from way back. I'm willing to admit it.
Brave man.
Very brave man. I think when we get through the rest of my music collection, people will be wanting to either scream or wonder exactly why I picked those five or six songs.
I don't think so. We had a few screams last week because my guest picked almost entirely opera, and people weren't expecting that at this time of the morning.
Well, I think I can safely tell anyone who might be thinking about switching out because of last week's
performance.
No opera today.
No classical. It's all popular music.
Most definitely. A bit of dance in there too.
As you would expect from a gay man. Now, Rod, we'll get into all your various bits of activism as we go along, but I want to take you right back to the very beginning, as far back as you can remember. Where were you born?
I was born in East Fremantle, which probably explains the dyed-in-the-wool Dockers fan that I am, at a little hospital called Woodside. It's gone now, Woodside Maternity Hospital, and back in the very, very balmy summer of November 1972.
Well, we didn't need to know that bit, but
I don't mind admitting it. It sets it up really because, I mean, I was the second born of twins, so yes. A lot of people don't know that, and 13 minutes after, so I am the one with the evil streak.
You're the mean twin.
Allegedly
the mean twin. Fremantle, 72. What did you have a happy home life?
Well, yeah, I did.
Because you're a fairly sunny sort of personality,
well,
I'd have to say.
Look, I had some challenges early on. At the time, my dad and my mum were together, and we lived in a farming property on the outskirts of the suburb of Armidale. Now, that now is completely infilled, and the block of land that we had there was literally rural based. Back in the 70s in Perth, really the metropolitan area didn't stretch out as far as it does now. We were there for around about 4 years. Then we moved into suburbia. Shortly after that, when I was about six, my parents divorced. I stayed with my mum there in the suburbs, and my dad went to the country again. So that was a bit of a challenge. I had an older brother who is 8 years older than me. He handled it a little bit better, but was to be, I think we fairly describe it, that without the fatherly influence, he was a little bit of a shit towards me and my twin brother. And I think I copped a bit of that as well.
Did he try to take over as like the man of the family?
No, he didn't. And in fact, later on in life, I can tell why that he didn't. He just was a little bit of a larrikin, and without a male parental influence. There we go. We can talk about heterosexual parenting and how failing it is sometimes. without a male role model. Oh God, I'm sounding like the Australian Christian lobby almost. He did get to get away with a little bit of stuff that I think back in those days, you know, the early 80s, I don't think most kids would have gotten away with. And he was a bit of a rabble-rouser. He's turned out okay now, but he used to make sure that we had a few Barneys, and being 8 years older, that could be sometimes.
Well, that's a difficult age, isn't it? Eight is a kind of awkward in-between sort of age.
That's right.
You're starting to clamber out of childhood towards adolescence, but it's not really happening yet. You know, there's little echoes starting to come along.
Well, that's right. When you're 6, 7, 8 years of age and your brother's 14, 15, 16, he definitely has an ability to beat you up.
This is about twice your size,
that's
probably.
Right. Exactly. But don't worry, I made sure I fixed that up by about the age of 18.
So your home life was a bit disrupted by the fact that you had this divorce and you had this sort of rather feisty brother to deal with. What about school days?
Well, see, that was actually where for me, a little bit of a sanctuary was, because although home life was not really divisive. I mean, I was certainly split between two parents. There was shared custody there, but it wasn't a miserable childhood to any extent. It was more a case, though, that it did allow me to distract myself by throwing myself into the books. My twin brother didn't, by the way. He distracted himself by throwing himself into antisocial behaviour. So one went one way, one went the other. We went from there. And
well, it didn't sound like there was much room for you to rebel with the other two busy doing it.
Well, I saved my rebellion for later. Most certainly did. And I tell you, when it came around to that particular rebellion, there were some very interesting reactions. But it was a case of I did really become a bookworm. And surprisingly, I actually don't like reading books now. I read the newspaper. I read widely for information. But I used to be really, really switched on, and I was very mathematically minded. I was top of the school in mathematics at my school, and then surprisingly, after I achieved what I thought was a pretty good result at my tertiary entrance and went on to university, I shocked everyone, even at my school, when I completely dispensed computing and mathematics and went and did a language at university. Mm. So I've always had this idea of challenging myself in one way or another, and thinking outside the box a bit. And it shocked a lot of people when they said, wait a sec, you should be doing computing, you're top of computing, top of maths, why aren't you doing that?
And why did you change to language?
Because I wanted a challenge. I actually sat down one day, and I always liked Japanese language.
That's a challenge.
I did do Japanese, and it is challenging. And another indication here, I think, as well, of another Japanese speaker in the room. But the thing, okay, that's fine. For everyone out there who can't see what Ben's doing.
No.
I thought, well, I could be doing computer languages, or I could be learning a real language. And that's what I actually came to. It was literally that decision. And
interesting, because you've got a whole kind of different mindset when you're talking about computer languages. And I suppose, in a way, Japanese is a very different mindset to a Western language, a different way of writing, and which I suppose, I'm a great believer in learning another language because you actually learn another way to think. Do you think learning Japanese taught you another way to think?
Most definitely, it did. And it is a rapidly different way of thinking as well, because you also have to learn in... My actual degree was Bachelor of Arts in Asian Studies, so I actually did an Asian Studies major with Japanese and culture, as well as journalism and geography. I put a whole heap of mixed bag of humanities subjects in there, and not one that was anything from the quantitative sciences. It was a challenge. And the other thing was that I actually really hated English. Believe it or not, I hated English at high school. I scraped through in English. I'm a journo by trade as well now. It's not. I just hated the teacher. I think I really did rebel.
That always has a lot to do with it at school.
It does.
I think.
I mean, I actually love the English language. I just hated English as a subject. Yeah. I thought, well, maybe I should go and do Japanese instead and have a bit of enjoyment.
When we say it's a different way of thinking, I mean, let's look at the way they write. I mean, we use letters to form words. They use a sort of
these ideograms,
almost a pictorial kind of way of writing, isn't it?
It is pictorial and based. I mean, there is a phonetic-based equivalent of an alphabet for them, but they also basically have adopted, Chinese script, which are ideograph-based. So you do learn underneath the meaning of those ideograms and the way they construct the language as well. It's quite interesting. And some of the things that we consider idiom in English, they have idiom in Japanese, and it's very, very interesting. It's culturally completely different, and also the fact that in their language they have a different way of structuring their language in regards to whether they're talking to people on the same level or a higher level or a lower level. English has that too, but in Japanese it's very, very formalised, and it's a very, very interesting thing.
We used to have it formally in English because we used to have, thee and thou for talking familiarly, and you was the sort of aristocratic form of address.
That's right.
As it were. And you still have that in the Germanic languages, of course, and in Dutch and in German and so forth. You have two levels of address, the higher and the lower.
That's right.
As according to whether you're talking to someone above you or below you. We drop that in English. But I'm fascinated about Japan generally, because it seems to have a lot of these very formal structures, and they're built into everything in Japan. They're built into social relations, they're built into the language, they're built into absolutely everything. So it's a very highly formalized, structured society. Has it changed from that at all? Because on top of that, you've got this big layer of American influence nowadays. So you have Japanese Elvises and Japanese baseball players and this weird kind of collision of those two cultures, which have really very little in common.
Well, true. And look, I think it's more of a collision of fun, if you want to describe it like that. There is, in every level of Japanese society, you're right, this structured, almost like put into a box situation. So everything from, say, corporate structure to home life structure to the way government works is all structured in a way that fits together like a perfect piece, almost. When things don't go perfectly in the Japanese culture, that's when you get the most interesting paradigms, whether it's the economy, which they still really haven't got their funk together on the economic front, or whether it's issues like, most recently, looking at GLBTI issues in Japan. People who don't fit inside the square actually are now being more accepted. But the way Japanese society handles those things, and also pop culture is, I think, the biggest influence on US pop culture on Japanese culture. It's just an amazing collision between, and this is why you see in Japan when you go there, this massive collision between the traditional and what is new. And in fact, I'd have to say that the new is dominated a lot by Western influences, and the traditional, of course, is just magical to look at.
Now, we were talking about your study of Japanese. I just wanted to backtrack very slightly there. When did you come out, or were you sort of out from the beginning, or, you know, how did that work?
Yeah, I actually came out well and truly into university. Not that I didn't know. I just had this particular mindset after going through, you know, a bit of rough and tumble with school life being the, brainy, smart type. You know, you do cop a bit of criticism at school and a bit of picking on. I thought, I don't want to add another one to that particular thing. So I thought, no, I'll wait till the more refined stage of university.
What people think before they go to university.
And it was always really, really good. I don't know how anyone could think that I could hide it, but I did. I do remember, I don't know if you've talked to Wayne Roberts from the Australian Bisexual Network. He's a nice guy, but he was at Curtin University as well when I was there. I got elected in 1991 to the student guild there. I started studying in 1990 at uni. I was on the guild council as almost like a Democrat cross-party section there. I wasn't part of the Libs, wasn't part of the Labor Party, the student Labor Party. I was there in the middle and holding the middle ground, balance of power situation. It was very powerful. And I do remember at one stage there was a bit of a discussion about the queer collective at Curtin and their space that we had on campus for them. For some strange reason, I don't know why this happened, they were worried about my vote on it, about whether I was going to support the continuation of the queer space at Curtin. Mm-hmm. Wayne bumped into me in the guild offices and basically chatted to me and, you know, was trying to feel out where my position was on this particular matter. And I said, look, I don't have a problem with funding of this. I don't think there's a problem. And he goes, well, thanks for that. And he tweaked my nipple. And I go, that was really uncalled for. And he was taken aback because he didn't know. No one knew. He goes, by the way, it was nice, but it was uncalled for. And then I just smiled and he goes, huh? And I go, yeah, you've worked it out now. I'll eventually say something. And that was like the first time I actually came out to really anyone. Then, of course, the next guild council meeting, which is only a couple of days later, there's all this whispers. Oh, my God, he's like that. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, and? It's like, now let's deal with it. It was really, really quite funny. But that back then in the early 90s, there was a bit of a blokey sort of attitude among the student union movement.
What kind of a university was Curtin? I mean, I went to Manchester in the UK, and it was fine if you came out, and this was a long time before then, and it was sort of reasonably okay if you came out if you were in the arts college, but if you were in the tech side of things, no techie would ever admit to being gay. You know, everybody who was in the local in the university gay soc and all that was all from the arts faculties.
Yeah.
So was it a particularly techie kind of focused university?
Well, yeah. I mean, it is the university, Curtin University of Technology. I nearly said the other word I like to put in there. Curtin University of Technology. So it does have a background. It was formed the WA Institute of Technology. Mm-hmm. So
that's what I thought.
It did have a very big focus on things like engineering, physics, sciences, chemistry.
Yeah, because we had the Manchester Institute of Technology, which is the same kind of thing.
But when it expanded into Curtin University, it also picked up business and nursing and all sorts of other areas, as well as humanities. So it was a broad-based university, but we got also remember back in 1990 also, when I went to university, I was still illegal then as well, because in Western Australia, we'd only just passed an age of consent bill that legalised same-sex behaviour between men, set at the age of 21, and the police were still arresting people aged 18, 19 and 20. So I was, in 1990 when I actually started university, I was still 17. I didn't turn 18 until 20th of November in 1990. And I actually didn't graduate until I was just 21. I actually took 3.5 years. So I was just about to turn 21. So I was completely illegal while at university. So there was a bit of a guarded culture still on campus, because I think there were a lot of people who were worried about the fact that while gay sex was decriminalised in WA, it was still illegal for anyone who was under the age of 21. And it was still punishable by 7 years hard labour. With whippings. Sorry, that's not designed to get anyone excited, but that was what...
It sounds absurd when we talk about it now, doesn't it?
It does.
We had the same again in the UK. We had initially had an age of consent of 21 and some very strange rules about what constituted being in private as well. Like a hotel room wasn't private, since a hotel was open to the public. I don't know quite how they work that one out, even if you locked the door. The scene as it was over there then must have been very kind of quiet and under wraps.
Yeah, clandestine in a way. But even still, it's like that. It's that strange situation you get in a situation of prohibition, that the police know what's going on. The police don't really want to criminalise somebody just because of who they are. They really, I mean, most of the coppers are pretty sensible about it, and they really would only go after somebody if they were going after somebody who was, you know, significant age difference or something like that, or there was somebody who might have been 16 or somebody who was 21 rather than somebody who was 18 and 70. But there were cases where there were some
both
bad
21.
Coppers. Yeah, and, you know, 18 and 19-year-olds and a 19 and 20-year-old, I can recall. But you get this situation where, you know, the Connections nightclub, one of the longest running gay and lesbian nightclubs in the Southern Hemisphere, I think, is in Perth. You know, you had this, because of a clandestine culture also, it developed and still is today, almost a one bar, one club culture. Everyone goes to the court, everyone goes to Connections.
There's one in every city, yes.
This clandestine, backwards sort of 90s,
I hadn't realised it was so recent over in WA.
Yeah, I mean, 2001 was our, basically our Law Reform Act, which gave us everything, also changed the age of consent, and in fact tightened up the age of consent. A lot of the opponents to the age of consent reform were really worried because, and I can remember some of the terrible things I saw in the West Australian newspaper, including by the fundamentalist lobby, a cartoon of a boy and saying that the gay men are going to come for your boys. And but what was really heinous about the age of consent up until 2001 was that a 55-year-old man could easily have sexual relations with a 13-year-old girl and get away with it merely by saying he had a reasonable belief that she was over the age of 16, and the age of consent was 16 for heterosexuals. And we, in our law reforms, we actually tighten it up to say that you have to be within a certain age bracket, so that if it's somebody who's 14 or 15 or 14 and 16, 14 and 17, I think it's within 3 years or 2 years of their age, it's lawful and it's fair. But basically, if it's anything outside that bracket. So we actually tightened up age of consent laws and made them work better. But all the fundamentalists could worry about was that a 21-year-old might have sex with a 20-year-old or an 18-year-old. But if it was a 16-year-old... or a 17-year-old, you know, there could be an issue there. But if it's a 13-year-old, then it has to be somebody who's 14 or 15, not 55. But they claim that a 55-year-old could have sex with a 13-year-old under WA's laws. It was absolutely heinous. It was a terrible, terrible situation.
Age of consent laws have always been very, very contentious, and a lot of them were very, very stupid. I just hadn't realised it was so recent that things got cleaned up over there, because, you know, we got legalisation in the UK in 1967 when I was at just in my final year at school. So I've had a bit of a while to get used to it. Talking about school and university and so on, when did you actually make the switch from being just a student politician to getting involved in gay and lesbian politics? Was that while you were at college, or was that later?
Yeah, at uni. Sort of resonated with me after sort of starting the coming out process was I also happened to fall for the very first love of my life, as is the terrible case. And that was an international relationship, which made it very, very difficult. It lasted 9.5 years, ended quite terribly, but there are good memories. But at the time, that was with somebody in the US, and It was also at the time, and this is why that last song resonated with me, by Timbuk3. In fact, I was introduced to that song by my former other half. We were trapped between two countries, and at that time, Australia didn't have good immigration laws, and the US had no chance of any immigration laws to allow us to be together. And so we struggled literally from month to month and year to year, getting a job in one country while the other person quits and travels on a tourist visa. And we did that for the better part of 5.5 of those 9.5 years. did a terrible, terrible thing to my resume. But at that time also, I was very, very interested. And this is where I sort of, answering a question, twisted in towards politics of a GLBTI variety. It was at the time when the Bayer versus Lewin case came up in Hawaii, which we almost saw as our day in the sun. If Hawaii could pass marriage laws, then we'd have the ability to possibly marry and immigrate and actually be together. So it was the first hope of a dream. And I became very, very involved in that. I was probably the most ardent offshore and onshore supporter, both in and outside the US, of that law, the challenge to the law. And I remember setting up the Hawaii Equal Rights Marriage page, the first, I think, internet web page to do with marriage lobbying. And it was just basically a clearinghouse of all the articles about the campaign. And I got to meet wonderful people who are still leading lights in the US marriage movement, people like Evan Wolfson from Lambda Legal, and a whole heap of other people. And it had me at my first Pride March in Austin in Texas, of all places. That's where my other half lived. And from there, it started me moving towards a path of being politically active. And the reason why the Timbuk3 song really resonates with me is that there is a chorus in there, a verse in there, between the choruses, should I say, where it talks about, you know, and this is in the early 90s, of course, that the response from government to GLBTI people was, we want you to have safe sex and use condoms, and that's it. And the line in the song is, you know, that, and that they were still pushing lines of, you know, decency and morality, and, you know, you can't go and do this and that. So you had the standards of decency and condoms for HIV, but what will protect us from prejudice and bigotry? That particular line in the song was what actually made me think, what is protecting us from prejudice and bigotry and all those things? What do we do to change society to be a better place, a more accepting place, to make us feel included, not just about equal, not just about being fairly treated and having anti-discrimination protection, but how do we change people's viewpoints and attitudes? And we still do it today. We still battle it today. But that is the big key question. How do we include ourselves? And that's when I thought, no, this is where I need to put all my passion and devotion in my private life, in my volunteering life, is to make the world a better place. And I sort of had that already when I helped set up an internet news group for a safe space for gay and lesbian youth on the internet, on Usenet back then. SOC Support Youth Gay Lesbian Bi.
God, Usenet. That's a term from history.
And, and you know, you'd have people post this safe news group. People can come in there and reply and be anti-gay. It was a moderated area. And I don't know what had more impact on me than setting up this safe space, but there was at some stages there, we had kids, and we still hear about kids even now. There's, I think, one case that occurred this week of another kid who's 13, they've been bullied and they committed suicide in the US.
Yes.
We had people coming through on Usenet who were kids, they were 13, 14, 15, from diverse areas of the world, and they were saying, and they, because every post they made would come to a moderator, what would happen is that we'd read their posts before posting them. Sometimes we get posts coming that weren't for public consumption. They were there to reach a moderator saying, I'm in trouble. I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm doing with my life. I don't know what I can do. My parents have just found out. I'm at fear of getting kicked out of home. What do I do? Who do I turn to? I need someone to talk to. And then you'd hear 3 or 4 weeks later, after you'd pass them on to some areas where they might be able to get some help, you get another email in from the same person saying, thank goodness I found you because I was going to commit suicide.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's when you realise that you can make a difference. Just one person can make a difference. And that drove me. That gave me the passion to say, I can make a difference. Somebody else can make a difference if I just encourage them to make a difference. And if enough people make a difference, we can change the world. Yeah. It's very, very powerful stuff.
Oh, yeah. It's a theme we constantly hammer on this programme, talking to Daniel Whithouse this morning. One person. It only takes one person. You know, you've got to do something. You're listening to Freshly Dug on Joy 94.9, and we have been digging not as deeply as we'd like with Rod Swift. We were talking about how you got involved in GLBTI politics, and it was interesting that you talked about Hawaii and about having an American lover and trying to make a transcontinental relationship work, or an intercontinental relationship work. As you may or may not know, my other half is American, and strangely enough, he's from Hawaii. So we had our hopes too when it came to Hawaii bringing in that first marriage bill, but it never happened, and it still hasn't.
No, it hasn't, unfortunately. And look, the US now, with hindsight and almost, what, 2 decades on, it's a real mess in the marriage stakes there. They've got a couple of states that have, a whole heap of states that have banned it constitutionally. It's a real mess, but look, the world's getting there, and hopefully Australia will get there one day. There's always light on the hill while people can believe and hope, which is sort of like where we are today. I mean, that's a quick fast forward, isn't it?
That's a very quick fast forward from where we were. So, like I said, from there, you got involved in this whole thing. You had this intercontinental relationship going. From there, you seem to have been into this in a very sort of solid way from there on, because you were convener, I think, weren't you, of Galois, or whatever, however you pronounce it. For how long?
For convener, I think around about 6 years there, from about 2003 through to 2008-09. Mm-hmm. And at various times also the media spokesperson, still doing that really in a way, and secretary-treasurer. All sorts of roles there, and that's just in the front of the organisation, and also through the 2001 to 2003 law reforms that we had in WA. I was doing a lot of media strategy as well, so it was.
Do you avoid getting burned out? Because so many people come in, they do these things for 2 or 3 years, and then they vanish back into the morass, as it were. How do you keep going?
Well, it's difficult because in a way, the last 2 weeks has been the closing of a chapter. The last weekend I was in Perth, was going to the annual general meeting of Gay and Lesbian Equality WA and handing over a thumb drive with everything, all the minutes, all the meetings, all the documents that we have, all the research to a new secretary and a new convener. And being able to actually close a chapter is very, very interesting. But then it's allowed me to actually look at literally all the books on the shelf and say, which chapter do I want to open now? And I'm in a state now where I can pick and choose what I want to do. I still think I'll be out there doing lobbying work or doing something, but maybe I've given 2 decades already to the community. Is, you know, and you get to the point, do I give another decade? You know, it seems like it's not so long. Do I want to really be 48 when I'm thinking about quitting this?
Maybe you could still do something in the community, but do something different.
And that's where I've been thinking.
Like presenting something on Joy.
Oh, now, see, now people are trying to ring in my journalism background. I look, presenting would be fantastic. And you know, one of the wonderful things I did was the first thing I actually got when I was sort of almost bi-coastal between Perth and Melbourne constantly every second week was I had the joy of coming into Joy and helping with the election night coverage for the federal election. And it was actually really good because it was my first real chance to be on-air talent again in a way that wasn't being interviewed by someone.
Yeah.
And actually be able to present with a level of expertise.
You did a bloody good job. You're listening to Freshly Dug on Joy 94.9. And we're going to stay with Rod Swift a little bit longer.
I was going to say, there is more to dig into my background, including being caught by many people who go, aren't you the person I saw dancing on the podium at the Court Hotel? That's a big story.
So tell us about it.
It would require a good half an hour, I think. One of the things that I'm known for is that I'm a bit out there. This is more of my personality, I think. I'm a bit out there. I like doing things that aren't inside that box, if we go back to the original conversation about Japan. I was always a bit of a larger guy, very big guy at one stage, and I have a good mate of mine in Perth. He's a DJ, he's now retired, and he always used to play all my favourite music at the Court Hotel, our only pub in Perth, and I had a podium reserved for me to dance on. And people used to come up and say, hey, don't I know you from the Court Hotel on the podium? Rather than, hey, don't I know you from television talking about gay and lesbian rights? It was always embarrassing. In fact, when I arrived here in Melbourne most recently, I went to a housewarming party. There was somebody else from Perth and goes, hey, aren't you the person from the Court Hotel who danced on the podium all those years?
And then, of course, we get evacuated down to the street and someone says, hey, aren't you the person I saw in IKEA the other day?
Which is exactly true. I am the mayor of IKEA now.
Why did you move to Melbourne? Why have you come back to us?
Well, through the glass I see a person that is the most special person in my life right now. And
he's here?
And he's here. No, he was originally from Perth, but we made a decision to move on, mostly because we needed a clean break for us to really live our life as we wanted to. And that did mean that I would be the one who'd have to throw it all away, but I've done it before, to pick up all the pieces again where they'd scatter and
hey, how else rebuild. Do you think I ended up in Australia?
Well, that's right. And you know what? It's, I encourage people to actually do it once in their life, to actually
at least
throw caution to the wind, throw it all away, and then find exactly where you are in life. It really, really is good. We decided to move here so my other half can go into teaching in a state school rather than a Catholic school. I think that gives away enough of the reason why we had to move from Perth.
I see. Yes. I actually agree with you about that. It's a very sort of therapeutic thing. It's a very frightening thing to do, to just throw everything up in the air and see what happens, to take a chance. I've done it actually twice. I did it and went to America, and then I did it and came out here. The trip to America didn't work. The one out here did. I've been here for about 15 years now. I don't think I'm going anywhere else. It does actually take you kind of outside of your rails that you tend to run on otherwise. Someone said to, well, in fact, people say to me at regular intervals, "Don't you miss England? Don't you get sick of homesick? Don't you want to go back?" And I say, well, actually, the weird thing about moving to another country and living there for any length of time is that there is no back. Because when you do go to the place you were in, it's not the place you left. It's moved on. It's changed. The society has changed. Everything has changed. And your relationships are not the same anymore. And you yourself have changed. You've been changed by the experience. So that there is no going back, as it were. It's a false, all that nostalgia for what used to be is absolutely false. And I think changing countries is a very good way to find that out.
Well, absolutely. And with my personal story, I mean, the reason why I left Melbourne the very first time in 2000 was I unfortunately was a victim of a crime here. It was quite a gruesome one, and I decided to retreat back to Perth at that time. People
were you bashed or what?
No, I was actually stabbed. It was on, I remember the night quite clearly. It was Christmas night on December 25, 2000. I was stabbed outside my workplace, and it was with somebody wielding two people actually wielding a syringe. I had to go through things like PEP at the time, and it was just not a nice situation to be in. And I retreated back to where safety would be, which was Perth, and I stayed there for the better part of 10 years. And you know, the funny thing is that cathartic things in life do change people. And we were sort of thinking about moving here around about 3 years ago, you know, starting to think about, you know, what do I do? Where do I want to be? I really do want to get back to Melbourne. And then my dad, unfortunately, was diagnosed with a terminal illness. And so we waited until a fair time after that to be around family and be there. So sometimes family is very important, absolutely. And where you're from is sometimes extremely important. But it's not the be-all and end-all of who you are and where you are need to be in life. And I've always thought that I needed to be back here. And it's so good that I am now getting back here, because it really is a case of, you do grow past where you are born and where you live. And if you want to become part of the world, sometimes you need to go and experience that. And it really does require cutting the ties and getting out of there.
Yes. Well, you get, you know, life can get too comfortable. You can get too stuck in doing the same things all the time. For a long time before I left England, I felt sort of vaguely dissatisfied without really knowing why, if you know what I mean. And then having once started on my travels, I was in Holland for 4 years, then I was in America for a year, then I was back in the UK for about 3 or 4 years, and then I came out here. But I knew I needed to be somewhere else. It took me a while to find out which where else. And I had some experiences along the way. But that feeling of, yeah, you know, my life's pretty comfortable and it's all going along pretty well, but, you know, like you said about learning Japanese, you need to challenge yourself.
Well, absolutely. And if you don't challenge yourself, you get caught in a rut. And look, I like to describe it another way. It's like having the most delicious piece of cake and it tastes like nothing. It tastes like cardboard. Life suddenly becomes this regimented and routine because you haven't had something shaking it up. I mean, gosh, we just got to walk down the stairs together. I mean, that certainly shook up my morning. But it's a change to the routine. It makes it different. It adds the spice of life. And I think that especially as you get on in years, and I mean, I'm not that old, but I start to think about, you know, what is legacy of what I've done and where I've been and whose lives I've impacted on, and what difference I might have made on this planet while I'm still here. You start thinking about those things and you think, well, maybe I need to go and grab these opportunities that will only present themselves once and that have come up by fortune or circumstance, and just take them. Because if you stay in your comfort zone, I think you actually miss a lot of those opportunities to expand and grow.
Yes, and the power of one, as we said earlier on, is something quite amazing. You see one person making such a difference. Say, I was talking to Daniel Whithouse about it earlier, and various people he's met travelling around Australia. It just takes one person in one school in one place to make a big difference, which brings me back to something you mentioned earlier on about how do we make a difference and how do we change society. And I think I'm at one with Ian McKellen on that one, who said the answer is schools.
Oh, absolutely.
You've got to have the next generation being brought up free from all this bigotry and bias, and you've got to get the point across before they get too brainwashed.
Well, that's right. I mean, back in the old days, it sounds old, but when I went through university, university was seen as that cultural change place where suddenly what you learned at school could be ignored quite easily. You could get people and educate them when they got to a more mature location like university. Nowadays, we need to get into schools. We need to talk about discrimination and why it's wrong. We need to, and especially so now. I mean, we've got a situation where Australia has moved on, that we are an open and tolerant, multicultural, multi-talented society with people from all different backgrounds and a diverse nature. We can't live in this colonial backwater forever that we used to have up until, I reckon, about the 90s, and WA probably till the 2000s. And we need to actually turn around and say, no, we are a modern democracy with advanced human rights and values, and we need to turn around and tell people that we exist as gay and lesbian people, because if we don't, we're part of the problem, not part of the solution. It's all about being out there, identified, and comfortable with ourselves in our own skin, and making sure other people can feel comfortable around us.
Which is as nice a way to sum up our conversation as I can think of.
I think so too.
All right, Rod, thank you for joining us today. One more track of yours before we go. I think it's got to be Pet Shop Boys.
Well, appropriate for the end of the conversation. If you're in denial, how can you be part of our wonderful, wonderful world?
Okay. Rod Swift, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Doug.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.